You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, March 27th, 2019, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Cara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
And we have a special guest rogue on this week, Dr. Tyler Black. Tyler, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thanks very much for having me.
Doctor, cool.
The doctor. So what are you a doctor of, Tyler?
So I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist. I work in Vancouver, British Columbia. I'm the medical director of one of the only emergency-specific psychiatric units for kids in North America.
Whoa.
Yeah. Gosh, I wish we had one of those here.
Yeah.
No, really, like, you know, I don't know if you know. You probably do because you've been listening, but I'm working in an adolescent residential facility now doing therapy with young girls. And crisis is the name of the game there. And I'll tell you, the crisis teams are so bad. The cops never know what to do. When we take them to ER, sometimes they don't even get a psych consult. And it's a lot. It's really, really hard to get them the critical care that they need. Obviously, if we can talk them down therapeutically and all of that, that's great. But sometimes we need psychiatric intervention. And it's just so mishandled.
Yeah. And you know, one of the benefits of specializing specifically in emergencies is you don't get as paralyzed by crisis as other units would. You know, if someone's, you know, suicidal or aggressive, we have pathways, we have nurses who are experienced in it, we have doctors who are experienced in it. So we kind of treat it like a psychiatric ICU for kids.
And it's
a really good model.
Yeah, that's really cool.
I mean, now that I hear about this, it just seems kind of obvious that every state, you know, in the United States, as an example, like, needs this or even more, right? I mean, is this happening now?
Typically, child and adolescent units are just one inpatient unit. So there'll be a pediatric hospital and then a psychiatric unit. And it's kind of a grab bag of everything from chronic problems like autism all the way through to the acute problems like suicide or psychosis. So you can end up kind of having a hard time managing all the patients at once. And then the numbers are often hard to justify having a unit. So our unit runs at about 66% capacity, which would drive most hospital administrators insane. But we intentionally want it at 66% because it ebbs and flows. There's days where we're full and there's days where we're close to empty. Actually, I left work today and we had no patients on the unit. But that's a good thing because it allows us to be rapidly responsive when we're needed.
Yeah.
Do people know you're there? Do they know that this, you know, facility exists and exactly what it's for, or how do they find you?
Yeah, so certainly, so in BC, you know, that's a very large province that has a huge distribution of geography problems. So there's small towns with 1,000 people, and then there's a smaller town with 300 people up a logging road. So we try very hard to communicate ourselves out to the whole province because we're actually responsible for emergencies within BC and the Yukon Territory. But obviously locally in Vancouver, we're very well known, and most, whether it's police or medical staff, they'll call us in crisis.
Do you think that there's something to be said about the difference between the healthcare systems, obviously, in Canada and America? We don't have as centralized a system, right? Because so much of it is private. But since you guys have a national healthcare system, do you think that that helps with people knowing that you exist and knowing to be able to utilize your services?
It makes it more likely that if you're going to see someone in the community, they know about the other resources that exist. It's less about advertising or what your insurance will cover, what's in network, what's out of network. Everything's in network. And it also relieves the burden of having to justify, you know, whether it's, you know, an insurance paying for something or anything like that. We just admit people who need them and discharge them when they're ready to go. And we're much less beholden to external forces.
Interesting.
Wow, yeah. That's great. Mm-hmm. So, Tyler, why are you here with us tonight?
Well, I became a Patreon basically as soon as you guys announced. I'm in a very fortunate position that I was able to sponsor you guys at a high level. I'd like to say I'm here on merit. I have had a few publications and stuff, but I did buy my way in.
It just turns out that you know, you're a doctor and you have...
I have done the pay-to-win model, but... It's, you know, I've been listening to you guys for so many years, probably since 2010. And it's one of my favorite things to do every week. It's something, you know, whether it's science-based medicine or just general approach to skeptical thinking, I teach it to my medical students and residents. I try my hardest to always apply it, with patients and in reading new research. And you guys are just a huge inspiration to me.
That's awesome.
And I would certainly encourage anyone who wants to support the show to be a Patreon. It's a very rewarding experience. The community on Discord is great. And it feels really good to contribute directly to something that you enjoy.
Oh, and we didn't even pay him awesome. To say that.
I know. Right? That was totally spontaneous.
That's so sweet.
I have to say that the two communities that the SGU has, we have the SGU forums and the SGU community on Discord. You know, we have, they're vibrant communities with a ton of daily conversation going on. And I feel very lucky that we attract, you know, these caliber of people. And they're just a bunch of, you know, like we hung out with patrons last year at Nexus, and it was a blast, you know, just a bunch of great people. But Tyler, I'm going to ask you to be really honest with me, okay? Don't you get a little sick of Bob?
I do not. you know,
wow.
So mean, brothers.
I know that's red meat that I'll try not to bite on, but I will say my closest alliance in terms of style of thinking and sort of being in the medical model is with Steve, but I always appreciate hearing from people who are interested in and discussing things that are outside of my area. So Bob is quite interesting for me to listen to.
Ha, Jay, suck on that.
That was interesting.
Yeah, that sample of one, Jay. A totally scientific survey.
Well, I'm a twin brother, so I know what it's like. Ooh. To be sick. Uh-huh. I have an identical twin, so there's a clone.
Identical, monozygotic. Nice.
That's
he's
so cool.
He's a lawyer, though, so I always say he's the evil one.
Do you read each other's minds all the time?
Yeah, that's how that works.
The closest we had was one time I was downstairs singing some silly song, and I walked upstairs. My brother was at the exact same spot of the exact same song, but I'm sure there was some second variable that I wasn't thinking of there, but it did creep me out a little bit.
I don't think that is that crazy, especially if you both got keyed off at the same time. You know, your inner
if you heard the same right. commercial or yeah. you yeah. heard yeah.
But you know what?
But
is
it was
weird.
The timing of it that was weird.
And Tyler, this I'd be curious to hear if you had any experience like this. I was reading an article recently about they were saying that twins can develop like a real verbal language with each other when they're very young that only they can understand.
We had that. Yeah, our mom told us that when we were, before we could speak English, we would babble at each other and we would have different babbles that meant different things. We obviously picked up English quite quick after that, but there is a period of time where we were basically inventing our own black language.
Mm-hmm. That's cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very cool. All right. Well, Jay, you're going to get to hear Bob talk a little bit more right now, because he's going to start off the news section by talking about a recent announcement about going back to the moon.
Yeah, we actually talked about this not too long ago, but this is kind of like a just two-day-old information that really changes things a bit. So NASA has been challenged like it hasn't in over half a century. The U.S. government is calling to accelerate NASA's plans to get our asses back to the moon with an ambitious new date. Boots on regolith in 2024, 5 years. That's what the plan is. That's what's being asked by Vice President Pence. He said at the U.S. Space and Rocket Center just a couple of days ago during the fifth meeting of the National Space Council, he said it's the stated policy of this administration and the United States of America to return astronauts to the moon within the next 5 years. So, yeah, so there wasn't a lot of detail. He did mention some interesting things. He said that he sees this as a renewed space race. Remember the space race with the Russians? Well, he's like, mm-hmm. he's like, we're in another space race. And he mentioned China's historic the Chang'e mission, which they have a lander and a rover on the far side of the moon. Like right now, it's there doing some cool stuff. He also mentioned that you know the Russians have been charging us $11 million per seat to get us onto the space station. That's
seriously?
Since what? Yes, yeah, and that's since 2011. I mean, that's a lot. Seats and lots of millions of dollars. And also the moon is going to be busy even later this year. India and Israel are planning to land a spacecraft on the moon later this year, and hopefully it'll work out for them. So he goes into some mission details, but they're sparse. But here's what he did mention. He said that the National Space Council will recommend landing initially on the moon's south pole. Why do you think he picked the south pole? Or
because of light exposure.
Penguins.
There could be water there.
Yeah, everything's right except the penguin bit. there's a lot of water down there, and they said that they could. They also mentioned that they could potentially extract water and mine oxygen from the moon rocks and use it for rocket fuel using nuclear power, which is especially fascinating and interesting. The sun down there shines almost all the time, unattenuated, at least at the by the tops of the rims of the craters. So that would make it especially efficient power source for solar energy. So that's another good option, and it could also lead. Their plan also was that this could lead to the more distant goal of permanent settlements. Alpha Moon Base, perhaps, would be nice. But there's so many ifs and buts to all of this. But I have to say, 10-year-old Bob is jumping up and down. Like, yes, finally, we're going back to the moon and we're going to stay there. But there is that weightless elephant in the room, of course. And, can this possibly be done in 5 years? I mean,
timeline during the space race?
10 years.
Okay, we've got a lot more technology now.
Yeah, I know. And that definitely is a valid argument. And they had tech that was really, surprisingly primitive if you really look at what tech they had. It's real. They wanted to do this by 2028 and now they pretty much cut it in half. So I couldn't find any serious discussions about increasing their budget because I just naturally assumed, you're going to give them some more money, right, to do this. And I'm not sure that they're going to do that. In fact, if you look, NASA's budget is supposed to drop by $500 million next year. And then they said that they were going to increase it by 1% every year after that. So that doesn't seem like much to me to pull off something like this.
Bob, I thought that Pence said, though, that they're going to get what they need to pull it off.
But he also said this, Jay, NASA must transform itself into a leaner, more accountable, more agile organization. If NASA is not currently capable of landing American astronauts on the moon in 5 years, we'll need to change the organization, not the mission. I didn't get anything solid that, yes, we're going to give you guys a lot more money.
Don't you think that's veiled language to say we need to strip away like Earth monitoring and we need to strip away climate science and we need,
He's claiming that the bureaucracies are slowing them down and making them much more inefficient. And I'm sure that that's true.
Oh yeah, nobody argues that
to a specific. Sure, absolutely. But achieving it now, it depends again on definitions. What are you trying to achieve to support the whole idea that funds are going to be needed here? Serious extra funds. A coalition of deep space exploration, which is a consortium of aerospace companies, they said recently that while they support aggressive timelines and goals, we also are cognizant of the resources that will be required to meet these objectives. Bold plans must be matched by bold resources made available in a consistent manner in order to assure successful execution. So sure, absolutely. So I'm just not sure right now what the plan is in terms of, are they going to get more money for this? Or do you expect them? Are you going to allocate emergency funds, if you will, to make that available to NASA? Or are they going to have to abandon some non-moon related projects? It's really not clear at this point. So, for example, NASA had plans to create that Gateway station, right? It was going to be a Gateway station in orbit around the moon that astronauts would live in there, and then they could take excursions down to the moon and come back. Mm-hmm. That's not going to happen in 5 years. Lockheed Martin said that they could probably partially create that gateway. So it wouldn't be the full gateway that they had planned, but it would kind of be this, a minimal version of the gateway. The lunar lander, right? We need a lunar lander, right? The plan was to develop these over the next 10 years. They do not have one. They have not issued any contracts, any commercial contracts yet. So that's a big item there that hasn't even been contracted out yet. Can that be done in 5 years?
No matter what, and I'm not joking when I say this, it better look really cool.
Oh, absolutely.
They have to, this is what SpaceX gets. They get that there's a romance with this whole thing as well. It has to be romantic. It has to look cool. It has to be, it has to look worthy.
Yeah, I'm also so glad that they're moving away from this whole Mars idea. Like, you can make the moon that target.
Exactly.
You can. It's closer. It's more realistic. It gets us out of orbit. It gets us to a point where we're, actually able to do larger space missions. And I just keep thinking from the photography side, imagining bringing a DSLR to the moon now, what you could do.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah.
That would be amazing. But then, you know, if they allow cameras there, they might, you know, they might prove that those people that said the moon landing was a hoax were wrong.
There'll be a new conspiracy theory. I just hope that they have enough spacesuits for the women.
Right?
Yeah, spacesuit technology.
Bring extra mediums.
NASA. Burn.
Extra mediums. So
can
the
you
other
believe that, by the way, Bob?
No, that was sad. I was like, what? Are you kidding me? Oh, they better specifically have an all-woman spacewalk, and then as soon as they can.
Yeah. Well, so here's the thing on that really quickly. So NASA has three sizes of spacesuits, medium, large, and extra large. They don't have a small one, and that leaves out a third of female astronauts don't have a spacesuit that is the size that they could fit. And essentially, again, they're going to have two women at the same time go, and they only had one suit ready that could fit them.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, they've been planning it also and, like, advertising it. Like, it's been a feather in the cap. Like, we're going to have the first ever all-female spacesuit. We talked about it on the show. And then they're like, oh, yeah, by the way, we don't have enough spacesuits.
I just think it's ironic it was a wardrobe malfunction.
Of course. Oh, no.
But the thing about spacesuits, to me, like, I didn't realize – I know that they're custom-built for them, but I also thought that there was – a little bit more accessibility to them. You know, I didn't realize just how rare a spacesuit is. You know, you know how like they show, we've seen this in movies where they get in somebody else's spacesuit. I guess that really doesn't work.
No, it could, Jay. There's three sizes, medium, large, extra large.
Right.
That's it.
Yeah, they're not custom tailored.
It's not per person.
No, they're just man-centric. Everything's always been very man-centric.
But if you mix and match the torso with a different lower pants with another one.
I don't think so, because they like lock into each other. There's a really good op-ed right now in the New York Times written by a woman. I think she was an Air Force fighter pilot or maybe a Marine fighter pilot, talking basically about her hot take on this very issue and about her history of working as a combat pilot and how she's had to sign papers that literally said, like, released the military from indemnification because if she ejects in her ejector seat, it's not built for a woman's frame and it might not protect her.
That's nuts.
Like, this is a common issue, for women, especially in industries that have always been dominated by men, is that it's men developing the protocols, and what ends up happening is that women's bodies, their actual physical bodies, aren't even taken into consideration.
One male size fits all.
Exactly. Yeah.
The airbag problem.
Wonderful.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, the airbag problem. We have it even in our local gyms, we still have this problem. Women don't fit the machinery a lot of times. Yeah. Anyway.
So the other thing, guys, that was talked about quite a bit regarding this renewed mission to the moon was talking about rockets. Rockets have taken up a lot of space in these stories, and that's because we don't have any that are ready to go to the moon yet. NASA has been working for 18 years on their SLS rockets, so that's a lot of development time, and they've had lots of delays. But when they're done, I mean, the stats on that rocket are amazing. It'll be the most powerful rocket ever created. It'll take a tremendous amount in one go. It'll take the Orion capsule. It'll take cargo. It'll take people.
Even more than the Saturn V?
Yes. In one of its
configurations.
Final configurations. Right out of the gate, it's not going to be as big as Saturn V. But the plan later on, once it's all been, all the doodads have been added, it'll be, I think it's a little bit higher payload than Saturn V, which is awesome, but it could take a little while to get there. Now, Penn said that they're gonna recommend going with a commercial rocket like SpaceX, United Launch Alliance, or Blue Origin. They're all developing rockets as well, less powerful but cheaper. But he said if SLS isn't ready to go, he would jump on these commercial rockets really fast. Now, of course, NASA didn't take any of this lying down. They embraced this wholeheartedly, as they should really. NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine said NASA and the SLS contractors like Boeing could accelerate their schedule so that SLS could be test launched in 2020, just next year. They recently announced that there were delays and that they couldn't have the first test launch until 2021. But like anything else, if you're properly motivated and compensated, you could definitely you can make many things go faster. So I'm sure they are extra motivated to make this happen a lot more quickly. He said our agency is going to do everything in its power to meet that vision, to meet that deadline. We got it loud and clear. So I'm sure he has he got this loud and clear. And then look, I one final quote here from Ellen Stofan. She's a former chief scientist at NASA. She now runs the National Air and Space Museum. Maybe we saw her when we were there last month, guys. Probably didn't. She says it was a sense of urgency that enabled the Apollo missions to successfully land on the moon for the first time. The same urgency is what it will take to accomplish a successful mission to the moon in the future. And this call for a specific landing date has that sense of purpose and urgency. I can't disagree with that. You know, that urgency can help you accomplish things that you otherwise might not have. But hopefully, you know, the funds will be there for them. I'd definitely not be happy if funding is taken away from robotic space missions, which have a much bigger bang for the buck in terms of scientific return on investment. But still, that 10-year-old inside of me is chanting Moon Base Alpha. Moon Base Alpha. Oh, my God. That would be so awesome. So I don't know. Yeah. We'll see what happens, but man, this got me very excited. The fact that we could actually be on the moon in 5 years. I'll have to see how this plays out because who knows? You never know what's going to happen, right? I mean,
are we trying to do anything new?
Right. Do we need to invent something new that's not already part of the
formula? Yeah. I mean, with all the orbiting space station and then the landers, I mean, they're all going to be so more complex and technically superior to what's gone down there in the past. So yeah, it's a orders of magnitude more difficult. You know, we're not going to build the landers that we had in the 60s. I mean, we could do that.
No, I hope not.
We might not even have the plans to do what to do. It's all brand new stuff.
Yeah, but it's much harder. It's harder, but we're building a better machine than the machine that we already built. You know what I mean? We're not building this machine from scratch. And the orbital thing is not part of this 5-year plan, is it?
Lockheed Martin said that they could have a minimal version of that gateway ready. So
but that would be like gravy.
Yeah,
I think there's also maybe a symbolic sort of part to having actual feet on the moon.
Exactly.
I know when I grew up and the Mars lander was so, like, even though it was just a tiny little machine, it actually humanized it a little bit. It mattered to me that it was there. I wanted it to do well. I was rooting for it.
Oh, it was so cool.
And to know that human beings are there, I think there's that, you know, we want people's minds to be captivated towards thinking about the solar system in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that obviously we need to have a safe machine that's going to get humans there safely. And, you know, in the 60s, those were not very safe machines. But we got to be thinking about things that are like live streaming kind of crap. You know what I mean? Like, that's what people are going to want to see.
It shouldn't be an afterthought this time.
Mm-mm.
Like, the multimedia presence on the moon better be like a primary part of the mission.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hope they're taking seriously, you know, what a deadly place the moon is, from radiation to micrometeoroids, solar flares. That is not a hospitable place at
Bob,
all.
Bob, you better call them and warn them.
I've heard, newsflash. I've done a lot of research on this today, just this specific news.
Yeah,
nobody's really talking about that yet. I mean, that's people. I'm sure these scientists know there, but maybe a lot of listeners didn't listen to that show when I talked about this 18 months ago. Mm. But it's surprisingly deadly. That's why we should.
Of course, it is.
The freaking surface of the moon.
Of course, it is.
No, but Steve. But it's not just like, oh, look, you're in a near vacuum, you know, a 250,000 miles from the Earth. It's more than that. You don't realize.
I know.
You know, that the radiation that's pelting you is they actually got lucky when they were on the moon for a few days. They kind of got a little bit lucky. If there was a big solar flare, they could have been toast. Yeah, it's really more. I'll put it this way: it's more inhospitable than you would think. Much more than you would think. That's why lava tubes are a great place. And the regolith, the dust, the moon dust is nasty, nasty stuff. They hated that. That was probably number one on the list for the astronauts. They hated that regolith, that dust. It got everywhere.
They really, I don't know, really clean that up. Just get rid of all the regolith. Bring some brooms and some
robot vacuums and you'll be good. But yeah, there's no dust in the tubes, Do it in the tubes.
All right. Thanks, Bob. Tyler, let me ask you a question. You said you've published some studies.
Yes.
Did they have p-values reported in those studies?
They did, yes. What do you, the specific what do you
think,
p-value.
What do you think of p-values?
You know, I've read your posts. Okay. not a fan. They're overused when they're significant and they're underused when they're not. And then the language we use when it doesn't work relieves our bias, just like our language used when it does work. So.
Yes, that's a fair summary. So there has been another salvo in the p-value wars. The p-value wars. We had a recent email where somebody said that whenever I say the word p-value on the show, his eyes glaze over.
I was going to say that sound you hear is 10,000 eyes glazing.
But seriously, they're very interesting and really cool, and the debate is really central to critical thinking and skepticism. So, and I could make it accessible even to non-scientists. So just pay attention, all right?
If you don't get it, you're just not paying attention. Hard.
Yeah. That's right. All right. So I've talked about p-values before. That's basically a measure of how likely it is that the results of the study would have come out the way they did, or even more extreme, if the null hypothesis were true. In other words, if there's no effect and these results are random, what's the probability that they would be what they are? That's the p-value.
If this is a chance finding versus a real finding.
Yeah, but it doesn't tell you what the probability is that your hypothesis is real. That's what it does not tell you. And you can't make that flip and assume that that's what it's telling you.
It's true. People use p-values the way they should be using effect sizes.
Effect sizes or Bayesian analysis or other types of analysis. So that's the other thing is there's also multiple other ways to analyze data. The p-value was never meant to be the be-all and end-all of statistical analysis. It's just a smell test. It's just, let's make sure these results are even minimally interesting before, and then we do more thorough analysis to answer the real question of, is the phenomenon likely to be real?
But don't you think it's because people who don't really understand statistics are like, I can read these results and I feel like I know what they say. Like the p-value, the sniff test of the p-value is chewable for a lot of people.
That's part of it. So I think part of it is our desire for simplicity. That's why, and I know I've given this analogy before, for years, digital cameras were sold with one number, megapixels. Computers were sold with one number, the megahertz. Megahertz. Like, there's actually about a dozen other numbers you should be paying attention to, and they probably have more of an effect on your computer's performance than just the megahertz. But people want the one number to rule them all, right, to make their decision for
them.
They
want to make it simple, right.
And so, so the oversimplification of the p-value as the ultimate test of whether or not the study is positive or negative or the phenomenon is real is way out of control and was never meant to be used that way. So the question is, how do we fix that? I think everyone agrees that that's the problem. Mm-hmm. But the question is, how do we fix it? Several fixes to this problem have been proposed. One is some journals have banned p-values. They won't even publish papers that have p-values included in them. That's the most draconian approach. I don't think we need to go that far, but that's one approach.
Those are like psychology journals too, aren't they?
You are correct. You are correct. Another approach is to lower the traditional cutoff for significance from 0.05 to 0.005. So at the very least, we're not flooding the literature with all these false positives because we have this borderline p-value. But now a paper has been published in Nature, signed by over 800 researchers, right? This is a commentary. And these 800 researchers just say, all right, we can keep the p-value, but we have to get rid of this idea of statistical significance, meaning creating an arbitrary cutoff and saying that anything above the cutoff is positive and anything below the cutoff is negative is just bonkers. Get rid of that idea, and you can report the p-value. It is what it is, but get rid of this binary false dichotomy. They make several very good points. One is that it actually encourages both false positives and false negatives. Rather than just putting that number into the context of everything else, plausibility, Bayesian analysis, effect size, blah, 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 rather than putting it into full context, it encourages, well, you eked over the line, therefore it's positive, or, oh, it's below the line, therefore we can completely ignore this as negative. It's a false dichotomy. The other thing, a really strong argument, which I firmly agree with, is that it massively encourages p-hacking, right? And we've spoken about p-hacking before. That's when you do things like, you know, make different comparisons or do different kinds of statistical analysis or collect a little bit more data or do these seemingly innocent things until you eke over the magic number of statistical significance. And then you say, I have a positive study. I can publish it now. I agree with that. I agree that, you know, we should not be treating statistical significance as this gold standard, binary, false dichotomy thing. I don't think we should get rid of p-values completely, though. And so the counter argument that some people are making, including statistical researchers, are saying if you completely get rid of the p-value, this will open the floodgates to all kinds of nonsense. Then what's the, right? There's basically no bouncer at the door at that point. Just anything could theoretically get published. You're getting rid of the smell test.
Yeah, but anything's kind of getting published now.
Well, that's the point. 100%. But yeah, you're right. Honest. But yeah. You're right. But it's going to be worse. It'll be totally open the floodgates. But you're right. I agree that that's a counter argument. It's like, well, there's not much of a gatekeeper now anyway, because you just p-hack, you do a little bit of p-hacking and you can get in. And then it gives you more respectability because you've been over the p-value. So that means people are going to interpret it as being real. So it's interesting. It's an interesting debate, and it is a systemic problem with science, and you have to be aware of it. So here's an example I used when I discussed it on Science-Based Medicine today, because I was Brian Dunning actually sent me an email and said, Steve, have you seen this study? I'm getting inundated with it. You know, help me figure out what the hell is going on here. And it was a study where they looked at the prenatal exposure to pesticides ambiently. So not eating them or working with them, but living near a farm, basically, right? So living within a certain number of feet or whatever of a farm where they're using pesticides. So it's in the air, right? And they found that correlated with an increased risk of autism. So, of course, the headlines are glyphosate, even though there was like six different pesticides, glyphosate causes autism.
Oh, you know? Love that.
Yeah.
So
not again.
Yeah, right. Again. So, of course, I'm like, okay, this is not a very plausible hypothesis to begin with. Let's look at the data here. And there was actually multiple scientists have already commented on it. And the top one, the first one I saw actually was what was my initial reaction, but they spelled it out more mathematically. So my first question was, how many different comparisons did they make? Right. So this is the testing multiple hypotheses or making multiple comparisons form of p-hacking. And this guy calculated that they made 66 different comparisons. They evaluated 66 different endpoints, and six of them were significant. And also the effect sizes were teeny tiny.
Wait, and what was their N?
Their N was good. I mean, they had, because again, this was an observational study. It was just like an ecological study. So it's easy to gather lots of data, right? Because it wasn't experimental.
But you're supposed to link those things. Like, you're supposed to look in advance. What is the statistical test I'm doing? How many contrasts am I doing? And then calculate, if I want to get us to a certain effect size, I need to collect X number of data points. Mm-hmm. So it's okay if you do 66 comparisons, if you do that calculation in advance and you're, you know, it calls for an N of 100,000.
You can adjust for multiple comparisons.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Oh, yeah. You can do a bone phoronic connection or something. Yeah, depending on what you're doing.
They didn't do, right? It was just, hey, we're just going to mine these databases for thousands of people and we're going to see if anything matches.
You know? Like cherry picking.
Something
to
like
me.
That even get published.
Exactly.
That's headlines.
The comment was, why is the BMJ publishing this nonsense? This is just data mining, doing multiple comparisons. A few of them had these razor thin effect sizes. It was like a 10 to 20% increase in relative risk, which translates to an almost no increase in absolute risk.
Right. Yeah. I don't know how risk is defined.
And when you actually do the adjustment for Bonferroni, you get you have to lower that 0.05 to maybe 7 to the 4th.
Wow. Yeah.
So it's so I ran it through a calculator and it said that that in 66 tests, you're 96.6% likely to find a significant difference by using 0.05.
That's right.
Well, there you go. Yeah, almost guaranteed to have a positive result.
And these confidence intervals were like almost overlapping with one.
Exactly.
Right.
And if you threw that to 99.99, there's none of those that would have even crossed any threshold.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So exactly. So this is why there's a replication problem. If you look at fresh data with these exact correlations, it's probably not going to be real because this is just random, you know, spurious correlations in big data set with very small effect sizes. So this is exactly the problem that this p-value adjustment is trying to fix. Interestingly, the authors were worried as much, if not more, about the opposite problem, rejecting the null as a false negative, just because it may overlap with the confidence interval may overlap with 1.0, meaning that it's not technically significant, but that doesn't mean there's no risk. It's like, yeah, that's true. P-values are they're not very predictive. That's a good way to think about it. What is the predictive value of meeting statistical significance? It turns out it's not very much because p-values themselves don't replicate, meaning if you did the same exact study 10 times with the same effects, same effect size, same materials, same methods, you wouldn't get the same p-value every time. You're going to get a range of p-values. So what's the real p-value? It's a meaningless statement. So p-values are not as predictive as people think they are. It really, you are just rolling the dice until you get over some magic number and then publish it. So I do think that whatever range of fixes comes to be generally accepted, I do think we should probably lower the number that we consider to pass the smell test. But I think that journal editors should not publish based solely on a p-value. I think they should publish whatever the p-value is, but just report the p-value along with other types of analyses that put the conclusions into the best context. And that's complicated, though, and that's going to be more complicated for scientists. They're going to have to consult more statisticians. It's going to be more complicated for journal editors, and it's going to be way more complicated for the media because they can't just say the study was positive or the study was negative. But the point is, no, that's the thing I'm most happy about, because it shouldn't be easy for the media, because it's not easy, because we should nudge them out of this false dichotomy simplicity that they take, because that's never the actual story. And they should have to talk to an expert to explain it to them. It shouldn't be easy enough that they could make up their own narrative because it was either positive or negative. So that would be a good thing. That would be a feature, not a bug, in my opinion.
But also, we shouldn't blame the media.
Well, you blame them like 30%, you know.
Yeah, but we should also blame some of the PIOs that are involved in this, because they're the ones feeding the press releases to the media. Yeah. And these PIOs
even who to blame
are
is nuanced. Yeah.
For the actual university that sponsors the scientists. And even the scientists sometimes aren't very good at communicating. Actually, lots of times aren't very good at communicating this stuff. So
if you ever want a good laugh, there's a blogger named Matthew Hankins that has a list of all the phrases that scientists use when their p-value is too large. It's about 700, 800 strong, and it has some great phrases like probably just under the borderline significance, or very close to the cutoff for significance, or well nigh significant. It's a great list. It's
I
really
like
funny.
A robust trend towards significance. Exactly. That's a pretty good
one. Trend.
Yeah, trend. Look, you know.
Looking good.
Not good enough.
Yeah, if you include the borderline stuff that's not even doesn't even quite get over that line, you could publish anything, right?
Oh,
anything,
and everybody does.
Yeah, I know. That's the problem. That's
right. Yeah. Well, and the reality is you could have something that has a p-value of 0.97 that is actually true, that is actually, you know, a significant result. It just, for whatever reason, in that particular set of data didn't come out that way. And so certainly you want to do something to change this dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
Teach more intensive statistic courses in college.
Yeah, I agree. I think that a statistician should be on every paper. Basically.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, yeah. I think it should be a requirement in
every
authorship.
Review board.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And every editorial group of a journal also.
There we go. Okay, we fixed science. Good.
Yay.
on to the next problem.
All right, Evan, so I understand that someone's trying to develop Synthahol, although they're calling it the wrong name.
They're totally calling it the wrong name. I mean, come on, Star Trek? We all know, we've all heard of Star Trek, I'll assume.
Yes, on the show.
I've heard of it.
Have you heard of Synthahol? synthahol?
No.
We don't have Star Trek in Canada, sorry.
That's what they drink, at least the next gen.
In the world of Star Trek, the synthahol has the same taste and smell as real alcohol to most humanoids, but none of the bad effects that are associated with alcohol, such as
intoxication. Well, it gets you drunk, though, right?
Now it supposedly does not.
Wait.
Slow down.
Alcohol is disgusting. You only drink it to get drunk. I'm so confused. Why would you want it to taste that way?
No, I think it does get you high in Star Trek, Evan.
My take was about synthahol. It was that you do get drunk, but you can turn it off if there's a red alert. Right. You could basically just like shut it down.
Oh, and you probably don't get hungover.
I got my notes from the Star Trek wiki, so I don't know where you guys are getting
yours. So they really said that you don't get drunk from synthahol.
They didn't say that. They said it prevents debilitating intoxication. So apparently you can get a little tipsy. But you can't get stupid stumbling, falling down the corridor drunk.
And why are we talking about this?
Yeah, why are we talking about this? Well, because, once again, science fiction comes into the world of reality, as predicted by Gene Roddenberry's Star Trek and that whole gang. So, the fellow's name, Professor David Nutt, N-U-T-T. He's the director of the Neuropsychopharmacology Unit at Imperial College in London. And to his credit, he has an invention for detecting inflammation in the brain of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's patients. So that's nice. But he also has an ambitious plan to bring safe synthetic alcohol substitute, which he calls Alcarel, to market. Alcarel. He's been, for a long time now, developing this holy grail of molecules that will provide the relaxing and socially lubricating qualities of alcohol without the hangovers and health issues. Now, Amy Fleming, she's the author of this news article, which appeared recently in The Guardian online. And when she consulted two independent alcohol industry experts about this, they told her that what Professor Nutt is attempting to do in the beverage industry is the equivalent of the space industry colonizing Mars. So apparently it's that far out an idea in the world of beverages and alcohol. Regardless, Professor Nutt and his business partner are trying to raise $20 million from investors to bring Alcarel to the market.
So what are its properties, Ev? What's the deal behind it?
Okay.
So can I just say out of the gate here, it doesn't exist, right?
Right.
It's just an idea.
They want to develop it, but so we can't talk about it as what is it. It's like, what do they want it to be?
Wait, why is this even a news item then? I'm so confused.
Right, because they put out a
pre-Elizabeth Holmes shit.
Yes, because they put out a press release saying, hey, we're raising money because we want to develop this cool thing. And then they talk about it as if it exists. But when you do a deep dive, you realize this doesn't even exist yet. They have no idea what this is. It's like an aspiration.
Yeah, it's an aspiration.
This person, Dr. Nutt, is actually my training before I went to med school was in pharmacology.
Uh-huh.
And he's a real name. He's a real scientist. He has published quite a few papers as well as, he's a big name.
He's a legit researcher.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of those things where, nothing that he's doing or he's talking about is a new idea. This idea of this perfect version of something that is all benefit and no side effect.
Yeah.
Right. And he's been
would be great.
He's been working on this since 1983. So, I mean, he's been in this for quite a long time, very active in the research.
36 years
studying the GABA system.
Mm-hmm.
GABA. Have we talked about the GABA system?
Gamma aminobutyric acid? Sure.
Right. The GABA system. That's Kirk and Spock and McCoy went there. It was one of those trick episodes.
We're orbiting GABA 5.
No. No, that's what Fred Flintstone used to say, Yabba Gabba Doo.
Right? Or that show, like that. Yo Gabba Gabba. Remember that?
Yo Gabba Gabba. Yeah, GABA is the main inhibitory neurotransmitter in the brain.
Right. In adults, yes.
That's
right. But if you have higher GABA levels, that means you're more loose, relaxed, your guard is down. And guess what stimulates GABA? Alcohol. Ethanol.
Mm-hmm.
Ethanol is a GABA A and
agonist.
Agonist. That's a good word, Kara. We should talk about that someday.
Oh, okay. I could add it to the list.
So when ethanol attaches to signaling molecules known as GABA-A receptors, it causes the release of GABA-A. And there are several different subtypes of GABA-A receptors, each of which triggers different reactions to alcohol, from the sedative effect to memory loss to nausea. And I imagine there's more. And there are three types of GABAs, GABA-A, GABA-B, and other than Kara, Steve, you want to guess the third one? GABA-C receptors.
Oh, shit.
I win.
So if you can block the GABA receptors, then you can block the effects of alcohol on the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And Nutt's been working on this since 1983 and actually came up with a substance that could potentially do this at the time, but they said it was going to be too dangerous to be of any clinical use, because if you accidentally took it when sober, it would cause seizures. Ouch. Mm-hmm. How does that exactly work?
Because it basically gives you like alcohol withdrawal.
Yeah, you can see why you wouldn't exactly want to make that readily available to people.
Alcohol withdrawal can cause seizures.
What happens if you take Narcan when you're sober?
Mm. Narcan is for opioids.
Yeah, so it's opioids.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
So if somebody,
it doesn't do as much, yeah.
Yeah, but if
it, you can just take it when you're sober and it has no effect.
But if somebody were addicted, if somebody was addicted to narcotics and you gave them Narcan, you could precipitate acute withdrawal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, which is not pleasant.
Not pleasant.
But it might save their life.
Yeah, but you do it, of course, they're not breathing. Yeah, that's what you do.
Yeah.
But for alcohol, alcohol withdrawal is actually really dangerous.
That's true. It's kind of like, do we have something for benzos like that, right? Because aren't alcohol withdrawal and benzodiazepine withdrawal kind of the
similar?
Only two?
They're very similar.
No. Just they can both kill you.
Yeah, that's because they're basically the same. And you can use benzos to treat alcohol withdrawal.
Mm. Interesting.
And there is a Narcan equivalent for benzodiazepines called flumazenil it instantly reverses it. So sometimes when we have patients who have taken too much benzodiazepine, we can give them an IV dose of flumazenil and they'll wake right up. It's like awakenings.
So what happens if you give a sober person that? Is it the same problem?
It's less. It's a competitive antagonist. It'll knock basically everything off of GABA. But the drugs that like the benzodiazepines are so tightly bind that the big thing is just getting the benzodiazepines off.
Gotcha.
And what
there's nothing on there, then it's not going to have much of an
effect. This guy is proposing is essentially what we call in pharmacology a partial agonist, or something that puts on some effect from GABA, but has a limit. So no matter how much more you give, it doesn't cause more and more effect. And this is the thing that was frustrating about this article is that it's not a new thing. There are many, many drugs that have been tried, even some of the famous sleep drugs with major side effects. Like I think in the States, you guys have Ambien.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All these famous stories about Ambien. Well, Ambien was supposed to be a modified, targeted, GABA receptor agonist. And so none of this stuff that is being discussed in the article is particularly new in the world of GABA.
Yeah, it's really just really, really challenging. But you also have to think about what part of the brain it's working in, right? Because inhibiting GABA in the frontal lobes has a different effect than inhibiting GABA in the parietal lobes or somewhere else.
Yeah, but if you take a drug, it's not going to have that kind of specificity unless you're looking at specific receptor subtypes.
There's different receptor subtypes that have various affinities for different chemicals, but also various distributions, and so
yeah,
it gets really
tricky. It's still going to be globally distributed. It's just going to be there's more of them in this region than the other. Yeah. There's no way that something like GABA isn't all over your brain.
Oh, it is. I'm just saying there's different subtypes of different distributions in different parts of the brain.
But so hard to target, and it's very complicated from what I've read.
Yeah.
But according to Professor Nutt,
if you're affecting brain pharmacology, you're probably getting to the level of causing potential side effects. So this idea that it would be like a food product is just incredible.
Yeah, I mean it's a psychotropic. Like it's going to have off-target effects. Things are going to happen regardless, right? It's impossible to take a psychotropic drug and have zero side effects.
Because there's inherent limits on specificity because even when you have different subtypes in different parts of the brain, they cross-react. Like you're not going to be able to purely stimulate one subtype without stimulating the other subtypes. So that's where you get the side effects. But the thing that is, I think, very plausible is that, one of the big problems with alcohol is not the alcohol. It's the acetaldehyde breakdown product of alcohol. And that causes the hangover. It's actually not the alcohol. It's the acetaldehyde. So if you could figure out something that basically acts like alcohol but doesn't break down into a toxin that causes a hangover and causes tissue damage and other things, that could be an improvement. And that's one of the things that they're working on, but they haven't developed it yet.
Right.
But that's more chemistry than neurophysiology. That's just in terms of like what chemically, how does it get metabolized by the body?
All right. So to clarify, though, coming full circle, they haven't made this molecule yet. They're just trying to find one that'll fit the bill.
Yeah.
But also remember that that's not really how – they're probably doing computational chemistry on this. Like a lot of people now when they're trying to do new drug development or molecule development is they model it on the computer. Because they can see the receptor, they know all of the binding sites on the receptor, and they can develop these new molecules and then play with their affinities on the computer first, almost like a video game. And then later they can work to actually produce it in the lab. So it's probably – I mean, I do think it's a little unfair to be like they haven't done anything. They've probably done a lot.
No, we didn't say that. They just don't have it yet.
Yeah. Like it might not exist in real life, but it might exist it might be modeled out completely. Mm-hmm. So, but that's step one. Then you got to test it.
Right. And again, there's always two elements here. There's it's functions neurologically, right? What it does to the neurotransmitters, the GABA, et cetera, in the brain. And then there's its chemical properties. How will it be metabolized? It's, you know, pharmacokinetics, pharmacodynamics. So, and again, with alcohol, both of those are relevant because it's not just the effects of the alcohol, but it's also the pharmacology of the alcohol and its breakdown products, which cause a lot of the side effects.
So we don't have synthahol yet. We'll have to stick with our Sorian brandy for now.
Right. Or Rigelian rum or whatever you prefer.
Nerds.
Yeah.
All right. Tyler, you work with children and teens, right, in crisis. So that obviously must include a lot of suicide risk.
Yeah, most of my research is in suicidology. And just to start off the conversation, I always, when I'm talking publicly, I remind people that, you know, if talking about suicide or talking about areas about suicidal thinking makes you feel worse about yourself or it triggers something, maybe this isn't the conversation for you. So you can feel free to skip ahead. But I usually, when I talk about suicide, I actually have quite a positive message. To put things into perspective, though, suicide remains the number one killer of people under the age of 40. So it's a big deal. It's one of those things that when you put it into perspective, it really blows you away. In Canada, if you take the top seven causes of death under the age of 24 and add them up, it's less than the number of suicides. And so, you know, it's trying to figure out when you see someone who's talking to you about suicidal thinking, is this person at risk for suicide? Yes, no. Is this person higher or lower? It's sort of like the holy grail of emergency psychiatry. Mm-hmm. You want to try and put people into these separate bins of high risk, medium risk, low risk.
Are you saying it's like the synthahol of psychiatry?
Exactly. Yeah. It's one of these things where I think, you know, it's a desirous goal, but reality is just showing us how much harder this is. About 18% of people at some point in their life, up to about 30%, depending on the study, will seriously consider suicide at some point in their life. And so we have to figure out a way when someone's talking about suicide, are they the percentage of person that's going to die by suicide? So,
oh, and it's so difficult. It's so difficult.
Very commonly, no. I don't know, Steve, if you've ever sent a consult to psychiatry, but often the question sent to us is, query suicidal or are they suicidal? And the answer is almost always yes, but that's not really what they're asking. They're saying, what is the chance this person is going to die? Or is this person high risk? Do they need to be hospitalized? Do they need treatment?
Yeah, usually, just to answer your question, usually when I'm consulting psychiatry for that question, it's the patient's already inpatient. And my question is very focused. Do they need a sitter? Right?
Yeah.
Which is, again, it's a risk assessment though.
Yeah.
And that's by the time it gets to you, like, my boots on the ground, I'm trying to decide whether or not this person even needs to go in, right?
Yeah, but see,
like,
again, I'm not seeing psychiatric patients. I'm seeing neurological patients. The guy's in there for a stroke or whatever, but he's very depressed and he's expressing, they're expressing suicidality to us, or we suspect that, you know, that they might be suicidal. Then we need to consult psychiatry to say, how do we manage this risk, basically.
Well, of all the things that we, you know, that we study, suicide is probably one of the more complicated ones. It's a myriad of risk and protective factors all coming together, plus randomness of chance. It could be as simple as someone getting a bit of bad news, getting a phone call, I just dumped you, or something like that. And then instantly someone who's at a very good place is all of a sudden at a bad place. So there's limits to prediction and limits to treatment. The article is a new one in the Journal of the American Medical Association Psychiatry by Dr. Belsher, it looks like from Maryland, trying to talk about prediction models for suicide attempts and deaths. And it's an excellent article where they went through the different studies that have ever been done that they looked at suicide prediction models. So this includes everything from a survey that might predict a suicide risk all the way through to very advanced neural networks looking at entire EHRs and looking at their prediction abilities.
You want to say what that is, what EHR is?
Electronic health records, sorry. So you know, some of these databases, one of the studies included, just this is just one of 26 studies that were included, is a national patient care database with 5,900,000 patients using the electronic medical record, and then a neural network to try and determine what risk factors could be. So this isn't just, you know, the failure of surveys or the failure of the human experience of trying to assess suicide risk. This is just all prediction models. And what they found is that the ability to predict suicide is near zero. And mm-hmm. and it's one of those things that, I think probably the best thing to explain it, and I know it's been talked about on the show before, is the most important number in a predictive test is the positive predictive value and the negative predictive value. The sensitivity and a specificity of test, we can find millions of articles that talk about those. But anyone who works in medicine or who works with these things clinically is going to zero in on what's the positive predictive value. So if you have a test that picks up 90% of all cases, but also gives a false diagnosis or a false negative to 10%, you know, the sensitivity can be very good. Let's say the sensitivity is it picks up 100%, but if it gets 10% false negative, it would have a 90% specificity. And so what really matters for positive predictive value is what's the actual rate of the thing that you're looking at. Mm-hmm. And so if you had something that happened 1 in 10,000 times, but there's a 10% chance of getting a false positive, you're going to get this huge gap, a 10,000 fold gap between, or a 1,000 fold gap, whatever the math is, between the result and the chance of the thing actually happening. And that's what we call mm-hmm. the positive predictive value. So putting all of the neural networks together with the studies and the surveys and all of the tools that we have. I don't know if anybody's clinically heard about things like sad persons or all these mnemonics that we use to remember things. The overall positive predictive value was less than 0.1. So that's less than 1%, which means we're still such a far way away from getting to a point where even with deep learning, we can figure out who's at risk for dying by suicide and who isn't. But it's actually part of a larger trend in suicide research that's been something that's been going on for about 5 to 10 years, which is we're in a model where everyone wants to stratify people into low risk, medium risk, and high risk. But there's no value to doing that. If I see someone at high risk and their likelihood of dying by suicide is, you know, measured in tens of thousands of people, then all of the things that I'm doing for that high-risk person, I'm just going to get complacent with them. And then the people who get sorted into the low-risk category are just typically ignored. So if I assess someone and they're deemed low-risk, they're no longer candidate for hospitalization. A mental health team might put them on a wait list. They might not get in to see a psychiatrist. Medicare might not cover whatever it is they're doing. And so stratification in general is really something that evidence hasn't been supporting for about 10 years. But clinically, you know, just administratively in any hospital, there's always this focus on, is this person high risk for suicide or low risk, high risk versus low risk?
Well, because we're so used to the triage model, right? Like we're so used to, obviously, we only have so many resources and we want to use them effectively. But I also, don't you sometimes feel like these, as important as they are, and if we actually were turning up good data, that would be really hopeful. But sometimes these very quantitative approaches to a much more qualitative problem are overlooking a lot of
Yeah,
things,
it's,
right?
It's so true. When I'm seeing a patient, you know, I've been doing this for 10 years and I see about 900 patients a year in suicidal distress. So I'm approaching, you know, 9,000 patients seen in acute suicidal distress. This is something where I love my job, and it's not, I don't get dismayed by any of this. This article doesn't bother me because the new approach that we're using is to try and take a look at all of the risk factors we can identify and all of the protective factors we know about, and just bring down the risk factors we see and boost the protective factors we know about for everybody. I don't care if you're 13-year-old female, no history of suicidal ideation, or 18-year-old male with 15 different attempts in their history. I'm doing everything I can in that person's profile to bring down their risk, and everything I can to increase their protection. It's no different than heart disease or all the other complex diseases like cancer that we deal with. And so it's one of those things where this sounds like really bad news, but I'm really hoping that it's going to start creating this wave within hospitals and systems, which has been really slow to adopt the science, which is that trying to predict is a fool's errand. Trying to classify people into high risk, low risk right now with our current technologies is not possible. So we should be doing everything we can for every single person over the age of 10. Suicide risk starts at 10, it increases throughout life till about 24, and then it continues on all the way through life. And I've never been reassured by knowing that someone's male versus female, or that someone's in a certain ethnic group, or that someone has a history or doesn't have a history. If they're talking to me, I'm worried about their suicide risk. Because again, to put in that perspective, it's the number one killer of people under the age of 45. If we think about everything that people get asked when they see their doctor, or they see a nurse, or they see a teacher, or they see anything, it's sex questions and do you use protection? But this is the number one thing that happens if someone's going to die under the age of 45. So this idea of just assessing this in everybody that we see and all the risk factors and protective factors, my hope is that it actually leads to better clinical outcomes.
Can you provide maybe what sum up for people who, you know, are interested in this and hopefully not triggered by this, or at least not so much so that they've been able to continue listening, what some of those kinds of risk factors and protective factors are?
Well, the classical ones that are actually predictive aren't super helpful. So being male, having, age has a risk prediction element, having a history of suicidal thinking, these are kind of obvious, but so many people have those things who don't go on to die by suicide or even have further suicidal thinking. So the number of risk factors is huge. I think probably the ones that people underplay the most are medical illnesses, whether it's cancer or pain, or any type of thing that causes a barrier in your life, it's there. And then impulsivity. We estimate that about 30 to 50% of people who die by suicide, really, it was not very predictable even the day or two before they were seen. Before the event happened, it was probably something because of a circumstance or an interpretation or a word that was said or a thought that came up. So the more impulsive someone is, the bigger deal it is. On the protective side, it's things that you'd imagine: good family connections, good friend connections, someone who has, more of a mindful set or a little bit more of a conscientious set, is able to put things into perspective versus being, more reactive. And then having actual connections to health, doing things that are healthy. We can't understate, doctors always get a really bad rep for pushing pills, but a big part of medicine is making sure that people lead healthy lives. And so a healthy life would include not only, getting your work done and all that, but actively relaxing, getting enough sleep, having time for social activities, having time to make connections. So there's quite a few protective and risk factors. Probably maybe 200 risk factors have been identified, and more than 20 protective factors. So it's impossible to create a scale that does all that. You just have to look at it for everybody.
What about things like having a history of severe mental illness, a history of suicide ideation, but also things like medication compliance?
It's the catch 22 of, when someone does die by suicide, and they were prescribed a medication, was it because their problem got worse or because the medication contributed? Often the advocacy people will talk about, whether it's a mental health advocate or a suicide protection advocate will talk about 90% of people dying by suicide having a mental illness. That number is far exaggerated. It's probably closer to 40 or 50%, because many of the diagnoses that they're talking about about, the DSM has a few diagnoses that are a little bit iffy when you really think about it. So an adjustment disorder, which is basically the DSM's way of saying you reacted to some news or you reacted to something inappropriately.
Yeah, that used to be a V code. Like, it wasn't even considered a main diagnostic category.
Or a specific phobia, or some kind of unrelated thing. Many people who die by suicide die very impulsively. And I've had clinical examples of people who fortunately haven't died, but have had major attempts where I had seen them the day before and they were golden. Everything was great. But then they got a bit of bad news or something they wanted didn't work out. And then instantly they're back to that place again. So this idea that people are walking around with this undetectable depression, and that's why these so many people are dying by suicide, is very simplistic.
So it's interesting that you brought up like heart disease, because that's the analogy that I went to immediately as well. And because it is nice to be able to know when patients are high risk versus low risk, because it can affect sort of the risk versus benefit of certain interventions. But it's a double-edged sword because, like, for example, women get undertreated for heart disease because they don't fit the profile, right? We don't think of them as being high risk. So they're having heart attacks that get missed, or they're having symptoms or risk factors that get missed. And I agree. And this is something I try to teach my students as well, is that, you have to consider all possibilities and you have to deal with everything that's in front of you. And don't think simplistically about, well, this is high risk, therefore it's true, or this is low risk, therefore they don't have it. Because you're going to see low probability stuff all the time. If you see enough patients, it's going to happen. So this seems disappointing on the surface that we basically have no idea, who's going to die by suicide or not. But it actually doesn't matter as much as you think if you're taking the proper approach anyway, which is, as you say, treat what you find, just in everybody. You shouldn't be overly reassured because somebody's low risk, I think, is the bottom line, right? Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And just consider, consider risk in all people and use that as your driving principle. If I see someone who has a mild depression, a lot of people would say that doesn't meet the threshold. I want to treat that person's mild depression because that's going to improve their risk of suicide.
Yeah.
So you just see what's in front of you, do the best you can with it. And I hope that stratification, until we get better science, I hope stratification sort of desires of administrators and hospitals goes away.
All right, so Jay, we may be approaching a very interesting milestone when it comes to renewable energy. Tell us about that.
We're there. So as predicted, we're seeing that it is now more cost-effective to build renewable sources of energy than it is to continue running most of the coal processing plants, in the United States.
Yeah.
So this is called the coal cost crossover point. It needed one more C, like the coal cost crossover
collapsing
conjunction.
Conjunction.
Yeah. Contra. There's another word there.
So in the United States, wind and solar are more cost effective than 74% of the existing coal fired plants right now. 74%. And I will explain what cost effective means. So in 5 years, this is expected to increase to be 86%. So to be clear, in 74% of the existing coal plants, the coal plant locations, when you include the fuel to run them, maintenance, and any of the other significant costs of running the actual plant, it's less expensive to build wind and solar farms within 35 miles of these plants than it is to continue running the coal plant, if you can believe it.
Hell yes.
Now, of course, the obvious bonus is that wind and solar farms don't produce any CO2. I'm sure that in the manufacturing process there is CO2 that's created, but nothing compared to what coal is doing. So over the past 10 years, we've seen solar photovoltaic energy costs drop by 90%, and offshore wind farms costs have dropped by 65%. Now, comparing the costs side by side, by 2025, coal plants will cost at a minimum 25% more than building new wind and solar generation. Coal is just too expensive. It's way more expensive now than renewable energy. And, you know, like I said, in 5 years, we're going to be at 86%.
Yeah, but don't forget, what the critical component, Jay, is that, you know, the sun goes down and the wind stops. So it all boils down to storage, right? And that's still a critical issue.
Yeah, of course it is. And it isn't an issue that has been, you know, it hasn't been solved in practicality yet because we're not operating on that type of grid. I mean, of course, we're going to have to, there's a lot of other things that need to be outfitted in order for us to handle this. But we do have the technology right now in order to store energy and to do this where it would be a net benefit all around. So,
okay, cool.
You know, I mean, think about it. You know, there's a lot of companies that are coming out with mass storage concepts, like the one that we talked
about.
The tower.
The tower is such a good idea.
It's such a good idea. It took me so long to understand what the hell you guys were talking about until you finally showed me the video.
And so there's really, for those like 85% or whatever of coal-fired plants, there's no excuse to replace them. You know, not to replace them.
They have to sunset them.
And yeah, they have to. But I do wonder if that analysis, what it assumes about grid storage, because at some point we will get to the limit where we would need massive increases in grid storage to continue to replacing them with renewable energy.
How much would we get to that capacity? Like, I wonder if somebody has done an analysis where they're looking at, you know, that capacity versus individual homeowners who are in a position to do so, you know, a financial position to do so, to get their own kind of batteries and things like that. Like how much it would offset if individually people took on part of that burden.
Yeah, it would help. So imagine if every home had battery backup, even a little bit for peak shaving. Yeah.
Like every home has wired like for electricity and has good plumbing. And yeah, just it became part of the norm.
Yeah, but that's what this article and this study went into as well. They were saying that the researchers were saying that moving to renewable sources of energy would immediately show cost reductions to consumers, right? Because, you know, of course, what I just said was it's 25% more efficient. Beyond that, if new solar and wind farms were built within 35 miles of the existing coal plants, and this is important, this would help transition communities whose livelihoods depend on coal, right? So right now, let's say you have a town that a lot of people in that town are working in and around the coal industry. So you can't just get rid of the coal plant and then that whole town turns to dust. You know what I mean? Like these people need jobs. So they were saying that you could replace lost jobs and even expand tax bases, which means that the community will have less expensive electricity, a cleaner environment, new jobs, because those people could be moved into jobs that would be working with the renewables. So in the end, people would end up with stronger local economies. You know, I did feel like, you know, the article was being very, very much positive about the whole thing, but I think we kind of have gotten to that point. I mean, we were talking years ago about, you know, when are solar panels going to get to the point where there's going to be a tipping point, and we're past that tipping point now.
The other thing is, though, I think that we need to throw nuclear in the mix is the bottom line, because we will run into the limits of grid storage, which we need to expand. But you know, I actually don't think we can build like the existing batteries, enough existing batteries so that everyone can have one in the home.
Yeah, we're going to have to see more technology.
Yeah, we need advances in battery technology. Absolutely. We need other forms of grid storage. And again, these are coming online. We're working on this. But I think that in addition to that, we need nuclear. And a lot of people do agree with that. We need the advanced nuclear.
Yeah, the new plants are way more efficient and produce a lot. They're smaller and they produce a lot more electricity.
And they're getting more cost effective too. The industry is moving in the direction of more cost effective because that's what's necessary, especially now that renewables are getting more cost effective. It's driving everything in that direction.
Just don't build them on the fault lines. You know,
yeah, right.
Okay.
Yeah, right.
Coal, you could think of coal similar to bloodletting. Like, okay, it had its day, but for crying out loud, I mean, how much more of the science? You know, what else do we need to do? Like, you know, are we going to wait until it's 50%, 75% more efficient?
No, it's not about the science. I mean, that's the truth of the matter. It's about the political will. So but those politics are going to be shaped by market forces.
Sorry, on the same day that that report came out that we're referencing, there was another report saying that the oil majors like Exxon and Royal and Shell – Royal Shell have spent $1 billion this year on lobbying climate. So,
yeah.
So the political headwinds, you know, for this type of change are just immense.
Yeah, but in mind, so first of all, this article was published in Forbes, which is hardly a liberal, you know, a newspaper. And the point here is that it's now economically a good decision, and right. That's even without that's without taxing carbon. That's yeah. without considering yeah. any of the externalized cost of pollution and carbon.
Well, how
which
much
is
could that
huge.
Be?
It's massive.
Oh gosh.
Oh, huge. It could be massive if we actually enforced it.
I mean, I'm just saying, but the externalized costs are massive. If
exactly.
we actually added that to the actual costs, then we would already be there in spades, you know, in terms of being cost effective. And that's kind of the idea. Let's just not allow them to kick the costs of pollution down the road.
Right.
If they exactly. actually had to cover those costs, then the renewables, which are already cost effective, become even more cost effective. It becomes a no-brainer, and right. that would just accelerate the adoption of these reduced carbon forms of energy, which is kind of the whole game, right? That's what we're trying to do. All right, Jay, you have to get us caught up from 2 weeks ago now with Who's That Noisy?
So like I predicted, remember last week I made a prediction that a lot of people were going to guess this thing dead on, and then I was going to get like – you know, the other half of that coin was that I wasn't going to get a lot of wrong guesses. I did not get a lot of wrong guesses because people either knew it or they didn't know it. So here it is. You can listen again. Some interesting things people wrote in. So, the Solomon family wrote in, "Hey guys, this week's noisy is a 2400 baud modem connecting to the internet. I rarely heard this because I was way too busy making dinner while waiting for my BBS welcome screen to come up." That was sent in by a listener named Jason. So Jason, that is very incorrect. I will play you.
Oh no, mean. My!
I will play you that correct sound. I'll play you the correct sound, and here it is. That's the correct sound.
And then wasn't it something like, "Welcome, you've got mail"?
Yeah, no, that's AOL. That's not AOL.
No, I know. I'm just saying that was always right after the dial-up. We all use the free disks. That's how we got our connection.
That's right.
I had
20,000 free hours or something.
Yeah.
So someone else named Paul White wrote in, and he said, "Is this from the Atari 2600 game Missile Command?"
Yes.
Ooh.
Oh, I love Missile
Is
Command.
It? Closer. You are incorrect. Here's what that sounds like.
Oh, yeah.
One more.
Wow. Oh, my God. Wow.
Man, now I want to blow off work and go to the arcade.
Yeah. Gosh, you can just hear the kilobytes.
It's so fun.
I know, you can, right, Ev? So, Paul, that was fun, but that was also incorrect. So now we move into the next section here, is who is the actual winner? So at first I thought, now I hope the person who I'm about to name came very close to being the winner. Wyatt Harrison wrote in and said, "Hey guys, I'm pretty sure this week's noisy is the battery powered version of Battleship. I remember having this game as a kid, and it certainly added a bit more fun in the game. Thanks for a great show." And then I got an email from Charlie Ross. Charlie is another patron of ours and a friend of ours. And Charlie wrote in, "That noisy for episode 714 is definitely the sound of a hit when playing the electronic version of the game Battleship." And he's absolutely right. It is the hit sound.
Yeah. So
I'll play the sound again, and this time I'll add a little bit more from the original person who sent in the noisy. That was from Joe Hansey. So here's the original sound before I edited it. So here he is keying in the coordinates. There's the missile coming down. There's the explosion.
We played that game all the time.
Oh, we killed it. We used to, if you remember, when we were playing the game, the first thing you have to do when you play the game is you have to type in all the coordinates of where your ships are. And we would have a race to see who can enter their coordinates in the fastest. So, Joe, thanks for sending that in. Joe and his nephew Sam were playing that game recently. So what was funny was I happened to be chit-chatting with Charlie, And I told him that he guessed correctly. And then Charlie writes back, "Holy crap, that's awesome. Thanks. I'd like to thank my publicist and my parents for not being genetically predisposed to deafness and my ears for not having been damaged by all those concerts in college and air molecules for vibrating the way that they do. And Milton Bradley for making the game and 12-year-old me for playing this game relentlessly until it broke."
Love.
So that was the very first person who had a award ceremony-like speech of winning Who's That Noisy. So thanks, Charlie, for winning. So I have a new noisy this week. Like to hear it? Here it go. The new noisy this week is... Oh, this one's really cool. I love this one. Check this out.
Wow, that was a really big moth.
I know, right?
Oh, that's so sad.
You can smell that one.
This was sent in by a listener named Timmy O'Keeft. So thank you. That one was really great. I hope that I get some good guesses on that. You can email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org, of course, with your guess. And please, if you have any noisies that you heard this week that you think I have to hear, send those to me as well. And keep it clean, folks. You know who I'm talking to. Anyway, there are some announcements, Steve. Announcements are very important.
Yeah.
So first and foremost, we are, as we speak, I will look up the latest numbers. Right now, the SGU has 3,267 patrons. When we hit 4,000 patrons, we will be having a 12-hour live stream. This is a live show that we'll stream.
Oh, boy.
And we're just going to spend 12 hours doing a victory dance. That's the whole show.
No, it'll be a 12-hour show, which will be a mishmash of things that you're used to hearing on the SGU. There'll be a lot of interaction with people that are viewing the show.
There'll be things that you're not used to hearing on the SGU.
If things go the way that I'm hoping, and I think everyone else is hoping, that we'll be actually doing a portion of this will be us acting out some type of Star Trek-infused, you know, fake Star Trek series, like a fake TV show.
All TV shows are fake.
Yeah, but you know what I mean. It'll be like,
no, I actually don't. It's
whatever. Okay, I should, you know, excuse me. You see how it works here, Tyler?
I think you guys should modify your game and play the world's longest. You could play What Isn't That Noisy. That
way. Jay, I think what we should do is we should invite our listeners to submit a recommendation for something that one or more or all of us should do during that 12-hour show. And then we'll take the one with the most votes or whatever. We'll use some method to figure out which one wins. And then we will do that thing, whatever it is people want us
so
to do.
So the audience will help so craft
we'll
the
pick,
show.
We'll pick the best bit ideas that people send in.
Yeah, but not just a bit. Like they can say, I want Jay to dunk his head in an ice bucket of water or whatever. Like something crazy like
what?
That. And we'll do
All
it.
All right. Well,
yes, let's, use that as a template.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, sure. Let's throw a pie in Jay's face.
Yeah, exactly. Just random examples.
Let me modify that a little bit. How about you actually spend a little bit of time thinking of something fun or funny that isn't ridiculous and email us at info@theskepticsguide.org and then put in the subject line, just put in 12-hour show. And then at least we can sort by them and see what you guys come up with. I know that a lot of you will probably, because of what Steve said, write some funny things. But yeah, give us some legitimate suggestions. I mean, anything to something you'd like to hear us talk about. Right, Steve? Like you were thinking along those lines to like just funny bits that we could do. Like I don't think if we actually are at the Star Trek Museum, which I still have not secured that, by the way, but I'm still working on it. Mm-hmm. But if we are there, you know, doing crazy stunts with water and food and stuff, we're probably not going to be.
Yeah, that'll limit what we can do. But we could do it off camera. We could do it out of the stage, I mean. Rather.
So I don't know how many of you are aware of this, but we are doing a show with George Robb. This is an all-day event. It's called The No Show, K-N-O-W, The No Show. And basically, this is an all-day mishmash of different things that we will be doing. You could go to noshow.eventbrite.com. That's K-N-O-W-S-H-O-W.eventbrite.com. The No Show is an all-day event with George Robb. Tickets are on sale right now. We will be doing a live SGU recording right in front of you guys. We will be doing there will be a musical interlude from George, which is basically, I think George will be playing some of his new music and of course some of his old amazing songs that he has. And then we will be doing an extravaganza, which is, you know, probably over 2 hours of us doing a show about science and comedy, and a lot of fun happens in that
zaniness.
Show. It's yeah. crazy. noshow.eventbrite.com for your tickets. This show is on April 26th. That's Friday, April 26th.
All right. Thanks, Jay. Okay. Let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. So there's a theme this week, and that theme is information. These items all have, in one way or another, have to do with the amount of information in different stuff. Are you ready?
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, yep. It's one of those, Kara. I know. here we go. Big numbers that'll blow your mind.
Yeah.
Item number 1. The water flea, Daphnia, has the most genes of any animal at 215,000.
Water flea, like a flea.
Yes. Yeah, okay. It's a flea. Yeah. Item number 2. 2.5 quintillion bytes of data are created on the internet every day. And item number 3, in order to learn their primary language, by age 18, kids store the equivalent of 1.5 megabytes of data. All right, Tyler, as our guest, you have the privilege of going first on science or fiction.
Not sure it's a privilege. So we'll take them in order, obviously. So the water flea, having the most genes of any animal, it's such a small thing. I have a, you know, I can't put it into words why I think this one's wrong, but I just feel like I don't know why it would. I can't think of a reason why this particular flea would have the most genes of any animal unless it's been attacked and it sort of had its genes spliced in by a whole bunch of things. But that number sounds fine to me. 21,500 genes.
215,000.
215,000. Oh, yeah, that's even worse. Yeah, so I don't even know what to say about that one. 2.5 quintillion bytes of data are created in the internet every day. That number, I literally cannot even imagine. It sounds like a lot. I'm betting 2.2 quintillion of it is porn. But it's just such a large number. I'm sure it's a large number. I think this is maybe an order or two magnitude too high, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's true. And it comes to the last one. In order to learn primary language by the age of 18, kids store the equivalent of 1.5 megabytes of data. Now, like text data, 1.5, are we just talking the words or everything they need to learn their primary language?
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
You know, because
compressed
text data, I would just think, you know, we almost always vastly underestimate the amount of work that our brain has to do, whether it's people saying that we only use 10% of our brains or only this one area is responsible for things. So I'm just going to say this one's on the fiction on the fact that our brains are awesome and it's probably many, many more megabytes.
Okay. Jay?
All right. The water flea. Daphnia, is that how you pronounce it, Steve?
Yes, Daphnia.
It turns out that this flea has the most genes of any animal at 215,000. So 215,000 what?
Genes. As it says right in the item.
All right, so the 215,000. All right, let me just move on because something doesn't feel right about that to me, but let me just keep going down here. 2.5 quintillion bits of data are created on the internet every day. 2.5
exabytes, Jay.
Thank you. I think everyone deserved that. All right, so 2.5 exabytes. I mean, sure, I actually don't think anything's wrong with that. You just got to think, you know, I always wonder, like, how do these companies, like, how does Google keep up with an Amazon Web Services? Like, how do they keep up with the increase in need for storage? Like, they must be in creating new data centers all the time and improving the ones that they have. Must be just a nonstop race. This last one here, in order to learn their primary language by age 18, kids store the equivalent of 1.5 megabits of data.
Megabytes.
Megabytes. Megabytes. That doesn't seem like a lot to me.
The two that have to deal with things that I am familiar with, the 2.5 quintillion and the 1.5 megabits, those things don't bother me at all. It's the first one bothers me. There's something not right about it. This one, this thing about the water fleas and the six legs and all these pairs of jeans that this bastard owns, I don't agree. I don't like it. This guy's probably buying lots of pants and then just throwing them away.
So the water flea you're saying is the fiction.
Fiction, yes.
All right, Kara.
All right. So
Kara, could you have more malaise in your voice, please?
I know. This is hard. Okay, so Jay went with the water flea. Tyler went with the 1.5 megabytes of data for kids. But that's only based on how much data they need to learn their primary language by 18. Don't kids already know their primary language by 18?
It means they're fully fluent and they have an 18-year-old's understanding of their language. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. See, the only one that I know anything about would be the water flea one, because like you said at the very beginning, Steve, this is going to be one of those ones where you could be off by an order of magnitude and I would have no idea. Like 2.5 quintillion bytes of data is a meaningless number to me. That's just lots. And even 1.5 megabytes of data is, I mean, it's not that many. It's smaller. We at least operate in the kilomega giga world, right? Because we use computers. But I still don't really understand how computers process my data. And like what, I kind of generally know how big a picture is, but a photo has a lot going on with it. And I think that you made a good point, Tyler, with text data. Language could all be text data. I don't know. That one's really confusing. I feel like it just doesn't have enough information. But when it comes to a flea is an animal. I'm pretty sure that animals are all diploid. So you don't get this weird polyploidy stuff like you get with plants. And I'm under the impression that like all animals are in the tens of thousands of ranges. I've never heard of any animal even having more than like 50,000 genes. Even that seems high to me. How many do people have? Like 20-something thousand? 30-something thousand? So to me, this seems like it is an order of magnitude issue. It just seems like a crazy high number for how many genes something would have, especially not a plant. Maybe there are plants in that level because they've got, you know, multiple versions of the same gene. So I think I have to go with Jay and say, Daphnia, be lying to us.
Okay, Evan?
So I have a feeling, I think I'm leaning towards Jay and Kara on this one. That's probably an order of magnitude larger. 215,000. I mean, it's like you took the number of human genes and just multiplied it by 10 and said, there you go. So I think that one's a little too neat. And I will agree that that is fiction. The fleas.
And Bob.
Yeah, I'm starting with three. Primary language, 1.5 megabytes, just a tad bit more than a good old floppy disk. I could see that for sure. I mean, if you add up all the words the average person knows, say what, 30,000 or so, maybe a little more, plus the grammar rules and other knowledge. Yeah, I mean, I could see that. It seems a little bit low, but that's definitely within the range of what I would expect. Yeah, 2.5 exabytes. That sounds about right as well, because I think we're well into the yottabyte range now for the entire capacity. Is that where we are? So exabytes kind of like, yeah, two levels down in terms of three orders of magnitude. So yeah, that's about right. I wouldn't be surprised if it was zettabytes per day. That'd be too much. And then petabytes would be too little. So that's kind of like in a sweet spot, I think.
You're just making all this up, aren't you, Bob?
So then, the water flea, yeah, now 215, I think. Kara, I think you hit it on the button there with humans have 20 to 30,000 genes, if I'm remembering properly. But I do know that there were other animals that blew us away, perhaps 80, 90, 100 or more. Even 215 doesn't shock me. If this turns out to be the science, I wouldn't be totally shocked, because I know there are some animals that have crazy numbers of genes. But that does seem a little high, for sure. And the fact that the other two in here, I'm fairly confident about. So I'd have to say that you all agree with me, or most of you do, that Daphnia is science.
Oh boy, you're gonna leave.
I'm in fiction.
Gonna leave Tyler out all by himself, lonesome.
Well, that still leaves a chance for Steve to sweep us too.
That's true. Or to be Tyler to be the only winner, which would be awesome. But I don't think it's gonna happen, dude.
Okay, all right. Well, we'll start with the one you all agree on. 2.5 quintillion bytes of data are created on the internet every day. Everyone thinks that one is science, and that one is science.
Yeah, baby.
Yes. And it's a huge number, but the internet's huge. It's amazing how much information we are generating. Oof. All the time.
Is just all of that stored, or is it just created and some of it?
Yeah, no, we can't store everything, but that's like if you add up all the YouTube videos, all the Twitter posts, all the photos on Instagram, all the Snapchat photos, all the everything. Everything
that's
flying
by. It's not just human generated. It's a lot of it is automated generations.
Oh, remember one of my predictions this year is that we've entered the age of the yottabyte, in which I think in 2019, my prediction is that a yottabyte of data will have been created and accessible. So that's...
All right, we'll go back to number one. The water flea, Daphnia, has the most genes of any animal at 215,000. The rogues think this one is the fiction. Tyler, you think this one is science. And this one, let me just say that Daphnia, which is a microscopic freshwater crustacean, actually. It's called a water flea as a common name, but it's actually a freshwater crustacean. Jace, I don't know how many legs it has.
That'd be a lot.
I couldn't find it anywhere. You can't really see legs. Two. When you look at it, it might have no legs. I don't really see. It has a bunch of things in its face, but I don't know if those are legs. Could be legs.
The face legs.
All right, where are the Daphnia experts reaching out to us right now?
Yeah. Those probably are legs, but it's hard to say. I can't tell how many.
Cute.
Yeah, they're cute. So it does have the most number of genes of any animal because its genes are multiplying. It's creating multiple copies of its genes.
Gene duplication.
So they're kind of increasing. It has way more than humans. The number of genes it has is 31,000.
Yeah.
So it was off. Yeah, that number did not seem right.
Yeah, Evan, you were right. I basically went 10 times the number of genes in the human genome, which is 20,000. It's 20,000. So we have 20,000. The Daphnia has 31,000, making it the most genes of any animal. And you're right, Kara. Plants are like crazy hyperploidy. Yeah. They just have tons.
Wait, 31 is the most?
Yeah.
I thought
they found some well into the like 50s, 60s.
That's the plants. It's plants.
Oh, okay. That's what
did I once read the
Kara was correct.
Onion has more genes than a person?
Yeah.
Oh, a lot of plants have more genes than people.
Oh, God.
Just because the way they reproduce, they duplicate their chromosomes. Some have like 96 chromosomes, 100 chromosomes. Yeah, they're just crazy. Mm. Yeah. And I just made it 215, so it wasn't a round number, you know, so that you would sound more real. But yeah, I made it big enough that would be a reason to suspect that it was a fiction. All of this means that in order to learn their primary language by age 18, kids store the equivalent of 1.5 megabytes of data is science. And this is a news item, actually. This is a recent study that was published in the Royal Society Open Science. Researchers calculated the amount of information to fully acquire linguistic knowledge. And if that were converted into binary code, it could be stored in 1.5 megabytes. Is that on a 1.5 megabyte floppy disk? Yeah, they said that kids learn about 2 bits per minute if you spread it out over the lifetime.
Average.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny because I think that 1.5 megabytes is a lot of information. And
I guess
it is, especially, you know, if you're converting that linguistic information into binary code, actually, that's a lot of info.
We're biased, though.
Yeah, but if I had this
hard drive.
Yeah, 20 years ago, we would think 1.5 megabytes is a lot of information, but we're just biased now by what's standard for a computer because we were thinking in terabytes, you know, gigabytes and terabytes. Megabytes is nothing. So we just sort of that's totally just a bias, but it's actually a lot of information. When's the last time you had a Word document that was, you know, beyond the kilobytes? You know, these are teeny tiny files.
And you played Missile Command earlier in What's That Noisy? And, you know, that game was probably, 2 kilobytes or 4 kilobytes?
Yeah.
You know, that entire game.
At most.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But yeah, it felt small, which is why I liked it as an item. But so good job, guys. Tyler, it's okay. You've reasoned your way well through the items. It is tricky. These guys have learned to know my tells, I guess.
No, not really.
Well, you guys can all stop arguing about who has the worst record, because I'm officially 0%.
Actually, I think I have the worst record when I play once or twice a year. All right. So we're up to the quote. Evan, you have a quote for us.
I do have a quote for you, and it was submitted by a listener from Belgium, Carl Walter. Thank you very much, Carl. I like this one. Skepticism is the ally of tolerance and pluralism. It prompts humility because it accepts that human judgment is imperfect and so concedes the possibility that our own political convictions, no matter how deeply held, may in fact be wrong. And that was spoken recently by David Lidington, an MP from Great Britain. And I like this quote. This is a sentiment that I have also held close to myself and expressed to other people as well. Your own political convictions may in fact be wrong. Check your biases, especially when it comes to that.
A little bit of humility goes a long way. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And there is an utter hubris in extremism, right?
Oh, yeah.
That absolute conviction that you are not only right, you're completely right.
Infallibly right, yeah.
Yeah, infallibly right to the point
where
that
you can't conceive of how you could be wrong.
Yeah. Or that the people who disagree with you are evil.
Yeah, and also that the vast majority of people are wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because most extremists are like in like the far end of the tail. Yeah.
Gosh.
But Galileo.
Yeah, right.
But Galileo. Yes, that's right. Very good, Tyler.
Galileo gambit, so often used, it has its own name. All right, well, Tyler, it was a lot of fun having you on the show.
Yeah, man.
Yes.
Thank you, Tyler.
Thanks,
so we always ask for our guest rogues, was it everything you thought it was going to be?
There is so much behind the scenes, so much swearing.
that's really the takeaway. No trade
quite
secrets.
Eye-opening. I might withdraw my Patreon membership.
Yeah, you should never see how this sausage is made.
Tyler, man. Don't you
never want to eat it again.
No, thanks so much for having me.
It's our pleasure. Thanks for joining us. Thank all of you guys for joining me this week.
Thanks, Doctor.
Steve.
Thank you.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.